But for some reason, the record, the chat got deleted. So if you are not on my email list, then I would ask you to just do that again, to stick your name and email on the chat. If you're getting my reminder emails, then you're good. Then you're on my list. But if you're not getting my reminder emails, that means you're not on my list. So I would ask you to just put your name and email address in the chat, and I will correct that. Last time I had done that before I had started the recording, and whatever, the chat only gets recorded if the recording is running. So that's what happened. I apologize. So if there's anybody here who's not getting my email reminders, please put your name and email in the chat, and I will take care of that. Okay, we are ready to start. I am going to do three things. First, I'm going to spotlight everybody. You can change whatever viewings you like, but that is for the recording. I am going to put everybody on a temporary mute. And share screen. Okay, you should all see the text of Shmuel Bet on screen. Yes? Okay, excellent.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm hoping that this will be our last session on this first unit, which is kind of the first piece of the story of David and his relationship with Bathsheba. We'll get to each one of my units is sort of revolves around a different personality in the story. So this was an introduction. We'll do a unit on Yoav, a unit on Uriah, a unit on Bathsheba, a unit on David and Natan, kind of divide it up into pieces. It's easier to, this kind of a story, it's easier to analyze from the perspective of each individual in the story rather than just the whole story at once. But there was a couple of loose ends that we left off with at the end of the shiur last week. I had suggested in a kind of a alternative reading of the story that if we're looking for a way of understanding what David was thinking in terms of why David felt a kind of a self-justification for his for allowing himself to get caught up in this kind of activity with Bathsheba, especially given the fact, all the evidence pointing to the fact that despite the fact that she's called Eshet Uriah, maybe there was some question as to the legal status of that marriage. Chazal looked at it from the perspective of this get that is not in the text. We looked at that from a possible alternative angle, which is the Uriah side, namely, what is the status of all of the individuals in David's army that are described as Hachiti, Ha'amoni, Ha'edomi, and all of these people that are identified by their geographic connection and a geographic connection to a nation or to a nationality outside of the domain of Israel. Are they Israelites who are simply living or are coming from communities in all of these external places, Chet or Chiti, or all the way up north in the area of Turkey, Edom, as we know, is Edom. Are they or Doega Edomi, Oved Itah Giti, or are they Gerim, converts, Gentiles, working, living, operating within the army of Israel? That is an open question, and the Mefarshim are split over it, and the possibility that it was part of a broader conflict of the status of bringing in people from the outside into the fold of Israel at that time. The terminology of Chazal to look at the question of Gerim and suggest that in the time of David, they did not officially, they didn't accept Gerim because they were always suspicious that the motivation was either the fear factor in the days of the conquering army of David or the power in the days of Shlomo. And that ultimately, even though there were converts, their status was always held in question. an approach that has a certain contemporary ring to it, I will admit, but it also resolves some of the questions related to the mystery. In other words, and I think this is a point we reiterated last week, the notion of suggesting that in some way the marriage between Bathsheba and Uriah was of questionable legal status because of the status of Uriah as a potential convert is in no way to justify David's actions, but to understand how it is that David could have justified his actions to himself. In other words, ultimately, what I'm looking for is a way of reading the story from the perspective of a moral offense that is much bigger and much greater than the legal offense, because the text seems to downplay the legal implications of David's actions and emphasize the moral implications. In a classic legal framework, the legal ramifications are no less significant than the moral ones. What we have here is a very unique scenario where the legal framework actually is of lesser significance than the moral offense. And so Chazal draw that picture through this issue of the get. And we had suggested that the way to draw this picture was, in fact, to look at the possibility that Uriah himself may have been not of Jewish origin, Uriah Hachiti, and therefore, from David's perspective, create a question as to the legal status of that marriage. That would explain a little bit of where David was coming from, not to justify it, but to understand how he could have enabled himself to fall into this trap. That's sort of where we left off. Yeah.
I don't understand what you just said about David calls into question Uriah and Bathsheba's marriage.
Correct. Were you in the share last week?
Yes.
Right. So that was what I was trying to address, is the fact that the moment I apologize if anybody wasn't in the share last week, the reason I asked that question is I apologize in advance. I haven't posted it, so the recording's not up yet. So that's why it's irrelevant. The moment I call into question the status of Uriah as a convert, meaning assuming he is Uriah Achiti, and therefore as a convert, if that conversion was not accepted by the Beit Din, then there's no legal marriage, which it's the same process, the same structure. So that creates a kind of, in David's mind, an opening that, again, morally has no foundation. But that comes back to what we said from the very beginning of our discussion of Shmuel ben Nachmeni, that the highlight of this issue, of this kind of approach, is Shmuel ben Nachmeni's separation between the moral behavior and the legal one. Whereas we tend to focus on the legal ramifications of our actions, the Nevi'im tended to focus on the moral implications of our actions.
A question? And
that was certainly the case in David. Yeah.
Are we to understand then that it can't be in the halachic sense or in the sense of the Tariq mitzvot adultery where both spouses are not Jewish or either spouse is not Jewish?
It falls into this kind of there are areas in halacha where the legal framework falls short of the moral one, what we would call the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. The moment the marriage is not a legal marriage in the halachic sense of the term, then classic adultery that is a death sentence, death penalty, capital offense does not apply. There are other offenses, but in terms of eshet ish, would not apply.
Okay.
So I also have a question. It mm-hmm. seems to me, taking moral, legal aside, mm-hmm. basically we go from he saw her, he inquired about her, knew she was married, whatever we want to talk about that, and then he did whatever he wanted. He just talked himself into what he wanted to do.
More or less, we're going to come to the question of Batsheva's role in all of this momentarily, because I don't think we can leave out the question of what Batsheva's role in this whole story is. And Uriah, it's a triangle. So we're dealing with a triangle. We've been dealing with one side of this, one corner of this triangle. There are two other corners to this triangle that we need to address.
I see that, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. he's the one who made the first move.
Correct. And that's why he's the one held accountable. Again, we're gonna work through all of this, but whatever we're going to say about Batsheva, and maybe this is my segue into Batsheva, the text, both in the text of Tanakh and in the writings of Chazal and in the Mefarshim, there's virtually no critique whatsoever of Batsheva. And I think that that's important. The entire, she's clearly the victim as the Navi presents it in many ways. We'll talk about that in a second. But there is no place anywhere in the story where she is presented in a kind of a negative light. There's no accountability on her shoulders. The Natan, when he comes to David at the end of the story, does not punish her in the sense of holding her accountable. She was punished in the sense that she's part of the story. When the child dies, it's her child. But at the same time, there's no critique of her, and certainly not in Chazal. Chazal present her as a very righteous woman, somebody who is the mother of Shlomo HaMelech, the sort of the moral standard bearer during the days of Shlomo, when Shlomo reigns and Shlomo is guilty of all kinds of offenses. It's Batsheba who comes to criticize him for it in the Medrash. She's really quite a towering figure. The one place where you see this most dramatically is the beginning of Sefer Malachim, which we actually just read as a Haftorah, where after or nearing the death of David, there's an attempt by Adoniyahu, one of the other sons, to rebel again and to assert himself as the king, as the heir to the throne, instead of Shlomo, because the stigma of Batsheba never gets erased. And so the heir to the throne designate, which is Shlomo, who's the son of Batsheba, is always perceived to be illegitimate because he is the son of Shlomo. And amongst the eyes, in the eyes of the people, they never accepted Batsheva's relationship and status with David. So she plays a role in that parak that is very positive. She goes to David, and then the Navi comes to her and says, you have to go to David, and you have to insist that it's Shlomo who sits on the throne and not anybody else. And she said, and David had promised her, etc. And so there's a partnership between the Navi, Batsheva, and David in terms of making sure that it's Shlomo who sits on the throne. There's virtually no critique of Batsheva in that regard. And that's something which we need to address and need to understand, especially given the fact that, as we said at one point, when she knows that she became pregnant, she does not inform her husband. She informs David. She knows the child is David. She knows that by informing David, that's going to create a series of events. One way or another, that's going to have ramifications. But her report is to David. That's a mystery. The behavior typically of somebody who has been taken by force forced into a pregnancy that's not by choice is to inform the husband, not the perpetrator. In this case, she informs David. That seems to indicate some kind of partnership or some kind of willing participation with David in this whole, give the terminology, sordid affair. And that's a mystery. On the one hand, we have this perception that she is quite a positive character, personality, and that she's not held accountable. On the other hand, she sets in motion the whole series of events because she reports to David that she is with his child.
Yes, but she couldn't report to her husband if he was far away for a long time. It wasn't his child.
No, no, of course it wasn't his child, but she could report it to him. Was what would be normal behavior would be for him to, for her to report to, again, coming back to the question, it was sort of addressed a little bit earlier, but coming back to the question of why David is allowed to marry her, one of the possibilities raised in the Gemara is because that initial relationship was forced, right? She wasn't by choice. But if it was forced, not by choice, then she would have reported to her husband that she was taken by force, right? That wasn't her choice.
Never having been in that situation, but I would assume that most people wouldn't, women, wouldn't tell their husband, but would tell the man who had impregnated her. That would be because he's the one responsible.
Only if she anticipates maintaining some kind of relationship with him. And only if she's not looking for a husband to kind of defend her honor, and she was taken against her will, and if she's a willing partner, yes. But if she's an unwilling partner, then why wouldn't she tell her husband?
Because the person
it comes back to the question of the Gemara. The Gemara says she was, according to one opinion, she was anusa. Anusa means she was forced. Forced either physically, which is less likely the case, or in this case, forced by position of David, of David's position of power and influence. He's the king. So if that's the case, she has a simple out. She has a very simple and logical, rational out. She was taken by force. Why wouldn't she tell her husband? The moment she tells David, she becomes complicit in the cover up, and she becomes a partner in whatever happens subsequently. That's complicated.
Are you saying she's an accomplice to his being sent to the front to be killed?
Again, I don't think so, but it certainly becomes complicated. She's as a silent partner in the whole cover up, and then David marries, like her role, I could easily portray a very negative picture of Batsheva, and yet Chazal are very careful not to do that. It doesn't take much to portray a very negative picture of Batsheva. Hollywood did a really good job of that. It doesn't take much because she knows she tells David, she knows of the cover-up, she knows that David has Uriah sent to the front. I'll even go one step further, okay? Just to kind of give us a little bit of a make life more interesting. Show an interesting contrast. After Uriah is killed, after this is in Perek, end of Perek Yud Aleph. I'm going down to the end of the Perek. Here. Okay, it's reported to David that Uriah was killed in battle. And we have the following pasuk. Vatishma eshet Uriah ki met Uriah isha vatisbod al ba'ala. The wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, died, and she eulogized her husband. And when the mourning was over, David marries her.
Does that undermine the get theory? If she's the wife after he's dead and mourning
she's
her,
always,
as
a... she's always again in the text. She's always called his wife.
Okay,
it's only right because that's why the text presented as whether it's legally or morally is not the issue. But that's the get doesn't appear in the text of Tanakh. Mm-hmm. But there's something odd about this pasuk. Something very odd. Vatishma eshet Uriah ki met Uriah isha. The wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, died, and she offered a eulogy for her husband. Vatisbada ba'ala. Vayavor ha'evel. The mourning was done. Vayishlach David vayasva el beito. David sent for her and took her to his house, and married. What is odd about pasuk chavav?
Doesn't name her.
Correct. She's not a nobody. She's a somebody. She's a Batsheva. Batsheva bat Eliam bat Achitofel. And the phraseology here is extraordinary. Batishma eshet Uriah, kimet Uriah isha. What would it have taken to say Batishma Batsheva kimet baala? Batishma eshet Uriah kimet Uriah isha. Uriah is mentioned twice. She's mentioned as eshet Uriah twice, and then she eulogizes. But Batisbod, not al Isha, right? There's two names for a husband. There's Isha and there's Ba'ala. And they're very different. Isha is a much more palatable terminology for a husband than Ba'ala. Even though in modern Hebrew, we use Ba'ala more than we use Isha, nonetheless, just to avoid the confusion between Isha and Isha. Everybody understand the difference between Isha and Isha? Right, this the word right here, Aleph Yud Shin He with a dot in the middle, called a mapeke, means her husband, her ish. Pronunciation wise, it's very close to Isha, which is a woman. So one has to be careful. In writing, it's easy to see. There's a Yud there and there's a mapeke, her husband, her man. Whereas when you're hearing it, it's much harder to hear the difference between Isha and Isha, right? Whereas Ba'ala is a different word. But in the writing, the use of the term Isha as her husband is clear. But when it comes to Batisbod, suddenly it's Batisbod al-Ba'ala. That's a bit of an odd shift. That by itself wouldn't be as significant to me as the fact that the name is missing. I will go one step further.
It takes the emotion out of it, makes it more mechanical.
Correct. That's exactly where I was going. And I would go one step further. There's another story in Chumash with a very similar phraseology that talks about the eulogy for a spouse. And I want to put them side by side and you'll see the difference. Okay, this is side by side. This, by the way, actually, I should put this in the chat. This is the new source page for today. So I will put this in the chat for if you want to download it.
I think Svi Tenenbaum had his hand up.
Svi, are you there? Did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I had it up, but I've taken it down.
Oh, okay. Was the question answered?
Yes.
Okay. This is no problem. This is the pasuk we just read. Vatishma eshet Uriah kimet Uriah isha batispoda ba'ala. I want to contrast this with the other eulogy, which is Abraham's eulogy for Sarah. Atamot Sarah b'kiryat Arba. Sarah died in Kiryat Arba. Be'eretz Knan, v'yavo Avraham lispod lisarah v'livkota. Abraham came to eulogize for Sarah and to cry over her death. By Batsheva it says, v'tishma eshet Uriah kimet Uriah isha v'tispod al ba'ala. Mrs. Uriah heard that Mr. Uriah died and she came to and she offered a eulogy for her husband or master. And she married David. You get a sense that there is a little bit of a, as Ronnie, as you put it, right? The emotion is missing. The eulogy almost sounds mechanical. She doesn't even have a name. Her status there is Eshet Uriah and Batispoda Bala, and there's no tear. Now, wouldn't Bannon of itself have missed that tear if it wasn't so clear, so evident in the story of Abraham's eulogy for Sarah? We spoke the Sarah v'liv kota.
She's doing what's expected of her without any emotional commitment.
So the question that I want to start with is correct. What I want to start with the question today is why? What is going on? She reports to David. She seems to be in some way silent through the whole cover up what that David tries to implement, including sending him off to Uriah off to the front. She eulogizes him, but it's seems to be very perfunctory. And then she marries David. It's almost and I have to be careful with how I say this, but it almost seems to imply some kind of participation, willing participation in this relationship with David? which is complicated. Now, clearly, the accountability lies in David's shoulders. Yet, I don't know, Bathsheba's role is totally innocent, totally bystander. David sees her, grabs her, takes her, and runs off with her. I don't see it. I see a kind of a, Hollywood did a good job of building that relationship. Here in Tanakh, it sounds like a one-night stand, but I'm not convinced that it was just a one-time-ish affair and done. There seems to be at least some element of a role of in the relationship between Bathsheba and David. And the question is why?
I have a question, Rabbi. In the next pasuk, they put it all in one pasuk, but what's the time? Do the rabbis discuss the time difference?
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
There's a huge issue in the timetable of this pasuk. We're going to get to that much later in the year.
Okay.
So,
Rabbi, I have a
question. Put that in the parking lot of questions to address.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
When you had the two verses up before between Abraham and Bathsheba, my question is, who's the writer, who's the author of the text? Because to me, if I read these two texts, I would say somebody knew Abraham and Sarah very well, and they didn't know Uriah and Bathsheba at all. So they're like a third party reporting so-and-so, wife of so-and-so. Gave a eulogy.
I mean, you look at the rest of the story. Look at the rest of the story. Whoever wrote the story knew them very well.
Clearly. Yeah, take it out of context of the rest of the parak and the
whole
story.
Yeah. It happens to be written by Natan, but that notwithstanding, whoever wrote this clearly knew the details of this story, either personally or through a Navi, right? It's part of Nevuah. It's part of Tanakh. So I would have a hard time looking at that. I think we take text at face value in terms of the messaging that it presents to us as written by the Navi. And that's sort of but I come back to the question, what role does Bathsheba play in all of this? Again, Chazal seemed to emphasize the role on the one hand, one possibility that David takes her by force, not physical force, I would assume, but some sort of power force of position. But at some point or another, that relationship shifts. And she becomes more willing and more of a partner in that dynamic than just a victim. And the question is why? I'm going to take this in a direction that may be a little bit surprising. But I don't think the answer lies with Bathsheba. I think the answer lies with Uriah.
Yes.
And what we haven't addressed yet is Uriah's relationship with Bathsheba. I don't know that we have enough evidence or enough information to make a concrete statement about that relationship, but we have clues. Like everything else in Tanakh, we have clues. So let's start with the first clue. How long are Uri and Bathsheba married?
I don't think we know.
I don't think we know. But the likelihood is they're not married very long. Why do I say that?
No children.
Ronnie hit it on the head because there's no children. They have no children. Clearly, they have no children because, first of all, there are no children in the story. And second of all, because if you remember the Rishonim, when they discussed the issue of the get, one of the opinions as to why you would write a get for your wife when you went to war was to avoid the potential issue of Yibum. That was Rashi's position. That would only be effective if there were no children. So there is a possibility that there is... again, that there's no children. If there are no children, they could be married for much longer and have no children. That would be more in line with other stories in Tanakh of women who are barren, but that's not the case here. And clearly, she is not The issue of the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba is not one in which they've been married for many years and they haven't had a child. Certainly not from the way Tanakh presents it. She's not described as one of the barren women in Tanakh. Unclear that Tanakh, that in the time of Tanakh, they had a sense of male fertility issues, because every instance of barrenness in Tanakh is identified as, if we go back to the Avot, as addressing the issue by the with the Shivcha. But nonetheless, there is this, so it could be that they're just young. They're just married relatively short period of time. In fact, and I'm going to share with you something which is somewhat radical, but there is a statement in the Zohar, and it's said in the Zohar in a different context. I want to take it completely out of context, but I want to show this to you because I think it highlights one of the issues. There is a Zohar that, again, the context of this is totally... V'gali kadamai is as if God is saying to himself or testifying, it is known before me, says the Zohar, shelo kariv ba le'alamin, that Uriah never touched Bathsheba. Doshmi chatum begavei l'saduta, my name is sealed as a witness. Ktiv Uriah uktiv Uriyahu, as if God's name is embedded in Uriah. Shmi chatum ba'adei, my name is embedded in his name. Deloshimesh ba le'almin, to testify that he never slept with her in any time. Now, again, the context here is the story of Uriah is a whole different context. I want to take it out of context completely. But the notion that the Zohar is suggesting is that that Uriah and Bathsheba, forgive the terminology, never even consummated their marriage. They never had relations with each other. Now,
so could it have been a marriage of convenience for...
I don't think it was a marriage of convenience. I think it was a frustrating relationship, meaning, and I'll explain to you why I say this. But again, the Zohar is a midrashic statement way out of context. And I don't necessarily have to take it literally. But the notion that somehow the relationship between Uriah and Bathsheba in some way is lacking significantly enough, A, for them to be young, to have no children, B, for the Zohar to say that he never even had relations with her, I think all of this points to a different issue altogether, which is the following. Assuming for a moment that they're young, assuming for the moment that they are relatively recent marriage, meaning young couple, married relatively, I'm not talking about young in terms of age, but young in terms of number of years that they've been married. Where is Uriah right now?
On the battlefront.
On the battlefield. Okay? On the battlefield. Who is Uriah in his story, in his personality? What do we know about Uriah?
He's one of the top 37.
He's one of David's top 37. He's one of the Gibore David. He is a loyal soldier in David's army from the very beginning. He also is he's a professional soldier. A professional soldier who wants to be with his unit, who wants to be on the front lines. When David calls him back from the front and says, Uriah, I want you to go home, be with your wife. Hello, Midarech Ataba. Why don't you go home? Go home to your wife. Go home to Red Lebetcha Urechatz Daglecha. Go home to your house and wash your feet. Spend the night with your wife.
So if he doesn't, is he actually disobeying an order?
Oh, we'll come to that. That's an issue we'll come to when we get to the issue of Chazal identify Uriah as insubordinate and treasonous. But we'll get to the why he's treasonous much later in our study of the parak. But there is a problem in that statement.
I do have a question. Is there any suggestion at all that, should we say, he wasn't interested in women?
No. No. Chazal does, Tanakh doesn't have that.
It's a good pretty touchy subject.
No, it's just not in the language of Tanakh to go there. Vayomo Uriel David. So what's Uriah's response when David says, go back to your wife? Vayomo Uriel David. Ha'aron b'Yisrael v'Yudah yoshvim b'Sukkot. The ark in Israel and the army in Judah, they're all sitting in the field. My master Yoav and the servants of my master are encamped in the field. That I should go to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife. There's a priority here. What's the priority? You think the priority is to go home and spend the night with my wife, have a furlough to go home? I want to be back on the battlefield. I want to be with my buddies. I want to be with my unit. I want to be on the front lines. Yoav is a professional soldier. He has Uriah. He's a professional soldier. He wants to be, if the army is engaged in a battle, the priority number one for Uriah is to be there with his unit on the battlefield fighting for Israel. In and of itself, that's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing. But here we come to a context that we've been avoiding in this discussion, not intentionally, but we just haven't raised. And that is where in the story of Sefer Shmuel, this episode is taking place. And it's just to go back to the very beginning. Perek Yud Aleph begins, Vahi l'tshuvat ha-shana, le'et tzeta melachim, v'yishlach tavid et Yoav v'et avadav imo al kol Yisrael v'yashkitu et b'nei Amon, v'yetzur ha-rabah, v'david yoshev b'yushalayim. The story begins when there was a very lengthy and protracted siege of Amon taking place, led by Yoav and his army. It's a year long. David goes back to Yerushalayim because David's not going to waste, you know, David's got other things that he has to do in terms of running a country. He's not going to sit there while the army is waiting for the siege to break. He'll come back when the siege opens up and the war begins. But they're sitting there for a protracted period of time in a siege of Ammon. What happened just before this? Before the battle with Ammon. I'm going to go back a little bit. Perek Yud is a detailed version of the story that appears in Perek Chet. So I'll show it to you in Perek Chet. But Perek Yud is two battles, two very big battles with the army of Aram, Syria. Aram Tsova, Aleppo, Aram Naharaim, Mesopotamia. Two enormous battles that expanded David's army over the entire region of all the way up to the Euphrates. That started with the battle with Ammon. We go back to Perek Chet. That started with the battle of Ammon. And included in that battle with Ammon was a battle with Edom. Actually, that's the end of, that's mentioned in Sefer Melachim, that the end of the battle with Aram was a battle with Edom that took 6 months. And then a battle with Moab, Yachad Moab. And there's a battle with Ammon. And there's a battle with Aram and Naharaim and Aram Tsova. And a battle with the Plishtim. Just go back in time. Just prior to the battle with Ammon was a six-month battle with Edom. Prior to the six-month battle with Edom, a siege of Edom that took 6 months, according to the Pasuk in Malachim, was the battle of Aram Naharaim and Aram Tsova. Prior to that was the first battle with Ammon. Prior to that was the battle with Moab. Prior to that was the battle with Plishtim. Prior to that was the battle for Yerushalayim. From the moment David enters into Yerushalayim, we're talking about several years of protracted battles one after the other. Yoav is a general. Yoav is on the battlefield. Uriah is one of his chief officers. Uriah has been on the battlefield for, how long has this all been taking place? 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? Unclear, but if we go all the way back to the conquest of Yerushalayim, it's quite a long period of time. Yerushalayim, Plishtim, Moab, Ammon number one, Aram Naharaim, Aram Tsova, Ammon number two, Moab number two, Edom, 6 months for Edom by itself. Now a year in Ammon and the besiege of Ammon. How long is all this taking place? Several years. And through all of this, Uriah is on his battlefield. And what about Bathsheba? One night, David asks Uriah to go home, to have a furlough, to go home to his wife, and he refuses because he wants to stay on the battlefield. I don't know. Maybe that's where the Zohar gets this extraordinary notion that they never had a night together. Uriah is a professional soldier. Doesn't have time for anything else. Now, unclear how much of this is in the story, how much of this is known, or how much of this she even shares with David. But if this is a part of the frustration, then I understand a little bit more of what is involved in that Vayidrosh, when he seeks out to understand who is she and what is her story, and a little bit of an understanding of her background, and the fact that Uriah is a Chiti, and therefore the marriage is of questionable status, and she's frustrated, and she's upset, and she is, okay, fill in the blank, because Uriah has been out in the battlefield for the last 5 years, hasn't had a night home. You understand the implication. Not only is it an implication for Bathsheba, take a look at this pasuk. It's a pasuk in Devarim. Ki kach ish isha chadasha lo yetze batzaba. It's a pasuk in Devarim. Man gets married, new wife, new bride, he shall not go out to the army. V'lo yavor alav l'chol davar, or be assigned to it for any purpose. Neki yeh leveito shana achat. He shall be exempt for a year to be at home, v'simachat ishto asher lakach, so that he can provide happiness to his wife who he has married. That's a pasuk in the Torah. I don't know, it strikes me as Uriah doesn't care about the samachat ishto, nor does he care about going home to his wife, even for one night. He is a professional soldier, sitting on the battlefield for year, battle after battle, year after year. The moral implication of a protracted series of wars will come back to haunt David, because ultimately that is David's downfall. The army is sitting out on the field for months at a time, if not years at a time. David goes home to Yerushalayim, and David finds himself in trouble. Can you imagine how many other people in the world of the people of Israel, right, their husbands are out on the battlefields? How many other Davids are floating around in the country? Right? David is the melech, so he's accountable. But the moral challenge to a society, a protracted war, year after year after year, the husbands and the men are out on the battlefield. This is not new to society. We're very familiar with the challenges that it creates. And so I would think, or I would guess, that at least in part, and again, it's a little bit more of a conjecture, but at least in part, Bathsheba's relationship with David is given a kind of a different picture when you consider that Bathsheba is a living widow, right?
A war widow,
because her husband is out on the battlefield for years and years on end. Add to that David's self-justification of the legal questions related to the marriage, and you have a formula for what eventually becomes the story of David and Bathsheba. Again, the tragedy, David's behavior is tragic, but so is Uriah. Uriah is not an innocent party in this whole story. And at least Bidei Shamayim, there's an element of accountability on Uriah's side as well.
Rabbi, isn't I don't know if it's in this context, but isn't David criticized for going back to Yerushalayim when there's wars to be fought? Like, kind of like with Moshe, you know, when David is there, they're successful, and when he's not there, they're not?
Yeah, there isn't an explicit criticism of him for it, but we will address that question when we get to amongst the tragedies of the story is the context that led to this chait, which is the David bin Yerushalayim when his army is on the battlefield. The question is, what was the alternative? You can't have a situation where the army is sitting involved in a siege for a year and a half, and the king is nowhere to be seen in the palace, right? The king has to operate around the country. So what was the alternative? If you've besieged Ammon for a year, what is the king going to do there? Just sit there and wait? That would be unacceptable either. So you know, that will come, we'll ask the question at some point down the road, what was David's alternative? And I think David's alternative is evident in the story when he realizes that what led to all of this is the prolonged siege of Ammon. So he comes up with a solution, which is to end that siege as quickly and as possible. But we'll get there when we do the battle strategy of all of this. All right.
You can make the same argument. He's been in Baal for 5 years. How did he run the country that for 5 years?
Well, it's not so much 5 years, but you run the country when you need to be in battle. You are in battle, but when you don't need to be, right, then you come back and you. I mean, that's how kings operated. But if it's not necessary, no, I think it's a problem. I think a prolonged, protracted battle is complicated. A war or a battle in and of itself isn't the issue. It's the siege. And the fact that the Torah explicitly challenges us or charges us not to engage in siege-style warfare is not an accident. I think there's a reason for that. Okay, so where are we at? We've addressed the question of the legality of Uriah and Bathsheba's status, and the potential loophole that David uses as a self-justification for his actions. We've discussed the possibility that Bathsheba, even if in an initial context, David takes her sort of almost by force, a position of his power, but at some point or another, she becomes a little bit more of a partner to David in the context, partially perhaps because Uriah is simply literally MIA, right? He's literally missing because he is in action, right? That is the context of David, of Uriah, who's a professional soldier for all of David's wars, and raises the question of his kind of abandonment of her and the tragedy that creates for her status and for her life. Chazal are very critical of that. And so that may also be a piece of this story. In the time that we have remaining, I want to take one more piece of this story on a much broader look. And then next week, we sort of move to our next unit. But we'll come back to our parak. One of the big questions, which I want to touch on briefly today, and we're going to address much more directly in a kind of a major, one of our last units in this discussion, is the overall, how should I put it? You know, there's a famous question: Ma ben Shaul David? Why is it that David, the attitude towards Shaul is so dramatically different than the attitude towards David in the aftermath of their failures? That's a very famous question. The way it's perceived, the way it's asked, typically, is Shaul, despite all of what would seem to be relatively minor offenses, not waiting for 7 days at Gilgal for the Navi, taking spoils of war in the Battle of Agag and the Battle of Amalek, what seemed to be relatively less dramatic offenses, is removed from the Malchus completely, loses his status as a king of Israel. Whereas David, who seems to be committing much graver, much more morally offensive actions, and yet is allowed to remain king. Not only king, but the shoshalet of Melech HaMashiach. So that's typically the question. In the language of Sefer HaIkarim, I'm going to... Why was Shaul punished to the point where the kingdom was taken away from him? And not any other kind of punishment. Whereas David was punished, and then Ashal David Anyam Batsheva was punished with all kinds of other punishments. The child dies, and he's smitten with leprosy, and etc. But the kingdom was not taken away from him. That's the question. And we're going to address this question at the very end of our study of the story, because I'm not sure that the assumption is correct. The assumption that David was not removed from the Malchus, I'm not sure is accurate, given the fact that this part of this story's aftermath is that Avshalom takes over the kingdom and David is exiled. So that sounds to me like David is removed from the Malchus pretty dramatically. So we'll come back to the assumption of the question. But for now, for today, what I wanted to look at was the answer that Sefer HaIkarim presents. And I want to challenge this answer, because I think that there's a big piece of the puzzle that we're missing. So Sefer HaIkarim, which is written by Rav Yosef Albo, a famous Sefer of response to the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam. Rav Yosef Albo wrote a book kind of whittling it down to three primary principles, cardinal principles, instead of 13, made it much simpler. But he also has a lot of other issues that he discusses in the text. So this is a quote from Ma'amar Dalet of Sefer HaIkarim. So this is what Rav Yosef Albo writes. Hatam bazeh lefi dati. My opinion is as follows. Shedavid lo chata the mitzvah pratit shenitzdava ba achar sheyamelech. The difference lies, says Rav Yosef Albo, in the fact that David's crime, David's sin, was not in a context of something that he was commanded as the king. Or be mitzvah pratit shenitzdava ba b'torah mitzad sheyamelech. It's not a violation of something which he was commanded because he was king. Every person in Israel is commanded in the prohibitions of idolatry and moral behavior, etc. That's not a king issue. That's just a personal offense, right? It's a violation of a cardinal chait in the Torah, but not a violation of his status as king. Because adultery and murder, which are the two kind of moral offenses here, not legal offenses, but moral offenses, are applicable to every person. And therefore, the punishment should be equal to the way any other person, ordinary person, would be punished. Shaul was punished in a mitzvah that was given specifically to him from the Navi, Mipi Shmuel, Achar she'yamelech, after he was anointed as king. And omitzat she'yamelech, it was in violation of a command that he was implementing because he was king, as in the Battle of Amalek. She'amar lo Shmuel, shivat yamim tochalad bo'elecha, when Shmuel said to him, you wait for me for 7 days before starting the battle against the Plishtim in Gilgal. Or v'amar lo gam lech likitet Amalek, or he told him to go in, take Amalek and not to have compassion and not to take the spoils of Lotach Malalav. And therefore, Ba'avuazeh, because his violation was in the actions as the king, Ba'asarat Malchuto Mizaro, his punishment was the kingdom was taken away from him. Mida keneged mida, measure for measure. Whereas David was punished as a person because his actions were in violation of Eshet Ish and Metzicha, etc., but not as the king. Because as the king, his violation was not as a king, his violation was as an ordinary citizen. So says Rav Yosef Albo, the Abarbanel, and a host of other mefarsh. And I want to suggest that Kvodobim Kumo Munach, with all the greatest respect to the Sefer Karim, I think in this particular instance, it's backwards. I think it's the other way around. We'll talk eventually about the question of whether or not David remains on the throne in this in a different context. But I don't believe that David's actions are accountable because he's an ordinary citizen. I think his actions are held accountable in the way they are, specifically because he is the king. The actions that he takes, his relationship with Bathsheba is driven primarily by virtue of his power as the king. You can't separate that. The abuse of his position as king, I don't think is any clearer than it is in the story of his relationship with Bathsheba and his orchestration of the death of Uriah. And those are precisely what the Navi criticizes him for. When the Navi comes to him and he says, "Ata ish," right? And you've taken Bathsheba and Uriah Achiti, Haragta b'cherev b'nei Ammon, he's not criticizing David as an ordinary citizen. He's criticizing David as the king of Israel for abusing his power as the king of Israel. This is also not a new phenomenon. This is a phenomenon which is common in the history and the annals of civilization, in Chumash and the Tanakh as well, all the way back to the beginning of Sefer Bereishit. And the Torah warns us about the potential abuse of the position of power of authority over and over and over again. I'll go all the way back to the Mabul. This is the end of Parshat Bereishit before Parshat Noach. So the transition between Parshat Bereishit and Parshat Noach, the introduction to the behavior of civilization that ultimately led to the Mabul. Let me read a couple of psukim. Vayhi ki echel ha'adam larov apnei adama, when man began to multiply in the face of the earth, ubanot yuldu lahem, and there were many daughters born. Vayu bnei ha'elohim et bnot ha'adam. This is a horrible translation. That is a horrible translation. The translation amongst all the Mefarshim, which is, I think, almost unanimous, is that this is not about divinity. This is about people of power and stature. The word Elohim is used throughout Tanakh, not only to refer to God, but also to refer to people, to judges, authority, people, people in power. God says to Moshe that when Moshe and Aaron will go to Paro, Aaron, achicha yen viecha, Aaron, your brother, will be your spokesman, ve'atati elol Elohim, and you will be his authority. That's, or the description of the Beit Din as Ada Elohim Yavod Vashnehem. Come to the Beit Din, you come to the courts, you come to the Elohim, you come to the people of stature, power. That's essentially what the vast, all the Mefarshim here describe. I'll look at the Mefarshim on this Pasuk, Bnei Elohim, Sarim, ministers, Bnei Shoftei Haaretz, right? The judges of the earth. Those who brought the mishpat, who led the country by virtue of being positions of judges, Ramban, Bnei Asurim Ba'ashoftim, the officers and the judges, Bnei Elohim, Bnei Asurim, all the Mefarshim. I sometimes have a hard time with translations that are just ignore the context. But anyway, this is not to be divine. B'nei Elohim, these people of stature and power, saw B'not Adam, the daughters of man, Kitovotena, beautiful, Vayikhulem Nashim Mikol HaShebacharu, and they took women as they chose. In other words, the stronger they are, the more the women were available for them to just grab, for them to just take, for them to just do as they wish. You look at the Mefarshim on that phrase, it's really quite extraordinary. Mikol HaShebacharu b'koach, by force, b'yad chazaka, with a strong hand. Hayu gozlim lehem b'notehem l'nishahem u'mashchitim seder olam. They would steal the women, whoever they wanted. Why? Because they could. Because that's what B'nai Elohim are. They are people of stature and power. And people of power, the potential for them to abuse that power is very dangerous. B'nai Elohim says Vayikulem begezel lebechoska mikol asher bacharu, ve'en miimchem biyadam, says Yevon Esther. There's nobody to stop them because they're the ones, they're the judges. Kehem b'nei dayanim. Who's going to hold them accountable?
Rabbi.
Yeah.
I remember learning with my cousin Michael that gezel was the sin, supposedly, that God decided to destroy the world. And
we're going to get to that in a second. Rashi. Mikol asher bacharu, they would take the women, whoever they chose, af ba'ulat ba'al, even from their husbands, says Rashi. These B'nai Elohim, people of authority, they would grab the women, whoever they wanted, even ba'ulat ba'al, even if they were husbands. If they had husbands, didn't matter to them. Why? Because they could. Because that's what B'nai Elohim were. Because that's what the potential, right? There's nobody to hold them accountable. The danger in that inherent position of power, if there's no accountability, is exactly this. There's no greater offense that defines an abuse of the position of melech than this behavior, which is exactly the behavior of Paro when he takes Sarah, or Avimelech when he takes Sarah or Rivka, or the people of Sodom, or Shechem ben Chamor. How many cases in Tanakh do we have? Or I'll give you another example, Melachim Aleph, completely out of different context. Story of Achav, Melech Israel, Ben Adad, Melech Aram, same Aram that David fought against. This Ben Adad, there are three wars that are fought between Israel and Aram in this end of Sefer Melachim Aleph, beginning of Melachim Bet. Three separate protracted wars. And they all start from this. Ben Adad, Melech Aram, Kavatz et Kol Chelo. Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, gathered all of his army together, Shloshim u'shnayim melech ito, together with an army of 32 kings, with horses and chariots, v'yal v'yatza al Shomron, and he set a siege against the Shomron. V'yishlach malachim al Achav, and he sent messengers to Achav, king of Israel. And when Achav was in a moment of weakness and looked like he was going to fall, so Ben-Hadad says to him, Mayomalo, Koamar Ben-Hadad, Kaspecha v'zavcha lihu, your gold and your silver belong to me, v'nashecha uvanacha tovim lihen, as do your children and your wives. They're now mine. Why? Because I'm the king, and because I can. Because that's how kings conducted themselves, and that's how kings behave. V'yan melech Yisrael, Achav's answer, as you wish. Because Achav didn't really think he was going to actually do it. Next day, messengers came back again and said, okay, pay up. I want your gold, I want your silver, I want your wives. Pay up. By tomorrow, I'm bringing my messengers to you. They're going to search through your house. Anything that pleases them in their eyes, they will take, including your wives. Because that's how kings behave. At that point, Achav gets nervous and he calls his officers together and he says, listen, this is a terrible thing. They're threatening to take they want my wives and my children and my silver and my gold. He reverses the order. And they all get together and they said, you shouldn't listen. And the rest of it is a war that takes place. But you understand the context. This is the behavior of kings. I am the king. There's nobody to hold me accountable. I will take whoever, whatever and whomever I want. This is exactly how the story of the Mabul begins. Yomer Hashem, skip to Pasuk Dalet, and the Nephilim ayu ba'aretz, great men of stature, giants in the earth. They would take these daughters, they would take them and have children, and this would perpetuated, and this cycle continued. That's where God saw that man's evil was great. God regretted that he made man. I will destroy man. Okay, let's go back a little bit down the line. Vayolad Noach Shusha Banim, Ela Toldot Noach, beginning of Parshat Noach, Vatishachet Haaretz Lifnei HaElokim, Vatimaleh Haaretz Chamas. The earth was corrupt before God and was filled with violence. Vayar Elokim Et Haaretz V'hinei Nishchata, the earth had become corrupt, Ki Yishchit Kol Basaret Darko, a man had corrupted his way on the earth. Yomer Elokim leNoach, Ketz kol basar ba'lefanai, ki mala ha'aretz chamas mipneihem. The end of earth is the end of all flesh has come before me because the world has become filled with violence. Dinim hashchita mata'aretz. So Rashi interprets this description as two separate offenses. Janet, you still on the call? We lost it.
I'm here.
Okay. So this is where you were talking about the concept of the Mabul. Right. Chazal, in the Medrash and in Rashi, quotes it, described this as two separate offenses. One was a corruption of sexuality, Mishkav Zachar, etc., and the other was violence. But ultimately, says Rashi, Lo nechtam gzar dinam ela ala Hamas, the final decree was because of the violence. That's the description here, where God says to Noach, Maha Aretz Hamas, of the two, the one that'll the straw to break the camel's back, if you will, the actual decree is over violence. There's another way to look at it though. If this is all a reaction to the behavior of Bnei Elohim et Benot Adam, people of stature, the abuse of power over with the women of the land, then it's quite possible that this corruption is not two separate corruptions, but one act that has two components to it. There is the violation, there is the sexuality of it all, and then there is the moral offense, the gzela, the violence involved in this kind of activity. The stealing of people's wives is both stealing and is in a question of the sexuality. Even if they're consensual, even if they're right, consenting people, you still have the issue of stealing the women away from the context of other people's homes and the status of as wives. So the gzela here isn't necessarily a separate act that they were stealing money and they were stealing women. And okay, we're going to define the mabul as having taken place because they were stealing money, as if that's a greater offense. It's not two separate offenses. It's one offense. But there's a moral context to that offense that's much bigger than just the question of the affair or the giliarios or the adultery involved in this kind of activity. Right? There is the gzeh, there is the corruption in terms of stealing of people's homes and people's lives and people's wives and daughters. Batimalea aretz chamas. That's the chamas that was permeating through the land in the years prior to the Mabul, That's the behavior of kings in positions of power, the potential danger that was created, and the need for a balance, the need for some sort of a system of accountability to hold kings, even positions of power, to hold them accountable for their actions. Paro, Avimelech, throughout history. When David falls into the same pattern, into the same trap, I don't think you can say that that's a prohibition or a violation that is as an individual citizen of the land. I don't think you can separate David's behavior vis-a-vis Bathsheba and Uriah from his position as king. And the proof is that it all starts because David was walking on the roof of his palace. Vayitalech al gag bet hamelech. He's not walking on the house roof of his house as a private citizen. He's walking on the roof of his house as the king. Vayari shavachetzet me'al hagag. From that vantage point, he then begins the series of events that leads him to, down the path of self-destruction vis-a-vis Bathsheba, Uriah, and its aftermath. So I come back to that statement of the Sefer Ikarim. Again, that's what he says. He seems to imply that the violation is not one of violation against the institution or as an institution of Melech. I would argue that the opposite is true, and that in fact it's precisely because of his status as Melech that has created this situation. I will pause now for questions and then we will adjourn.
It just seems to me that nothing changes.
No.
Men of power can do whatever they want.
Unless they're held accountable. Unless there's a value system in society that is able to hold them accountable. That is 100% correct. And that's why the story's in Tanakh. Come back to that again and again. That's why it's in Tanakh. Because it's there as a warning. If David could fall, so could anybody else. Nobody. Mm-hmm. Chazal say it very clearly. Ein apitropos l'arayas, Chazal say. You ever hear the expression? Ein apitropos l'arayas. There is no guarantee against the fall into the trap of sexual promiscuity and violation. The person is constantly has to be vigilant and has to be careful. That's why there's Isurim like Yichud. That's why there are precautions. Right? There are lots of safeguards in order to prevent a person from saying, I'm above those safeguards. I'm fine. Right? Because it doesn't work that way. The reality is, I'm just going to stop the share for a second. Right? The reality is it doesn't work that way. There are no guarantees. And the stronger and more powerful a person is in terms of position, the more the need for the safeguards in place to protect those who are more vulnerable. 100%. Okay. That is the end of this first unit on David and Bathsheba. Next week, Bezrat Hashem, we will explore a little bit more in detail the battle and Uriah and and the relationship between Uriah and David. And then we'll move on from there one step at a time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Where can we get the recording again?
Thank you.
So let me put that on the chat. The recordings are all on the shul website. And let me just, let's do this. I'm just going to